Nuclear cover-ups. It's one thing to say that nuclear power is not the solution to climate change, but that verifiable fact has been ignored in the face of a deluge of techniques used by the nuclear industry to justify and promote its very existence. How is it that this industry, nuclear, gets away with its outrageous claims and denials of harm without accountability? Is it indicative of a deeper level of injustice that runs the world? It takes a genuine expert on not only the science, but the political, social, and media issues surrounding this dangerous technology to boil it down to the basics. And when he tells you,
The larger society, it's not specific to nuclear energy. It is to how our society is structured in such an unequal fashion with gross inequalities of wealth and power, and how the people who are wealthy use the wealth to get power to get things done the way they want, while at the same time passing on the costs and the risks to the vast majority of the public.
well, when an expert physicist explains not only what the nuclear industry is getting away with, but the many ways at play with which they accomplish it, while also giving us the greater truth about nuclear dangers that give lie to the industry's lies about being the solution to climate change, you get another set of angles on that dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, physicist M.V. Ramana, on his new book, Nuclear is Not the Solution: The Folly of Atomic Power in the Age of Climate Change.
Today is Tuesday, September 16, 2025.
And here is this week's special full-length interview. It's always great when new books get published about nuclear, and there have been several that we will be covering in the coming weeks. Right now, I want to bring your attention to an important new book that has just been published by M.V. Ramana. It's entitled Nuclear is Not the Solution: The Folly of Atomic Power in the Age of Climate Change. In it, this much lauded physicist has laid out the case against nuclear in clear, concise, easy to understand language, which means he's an important interviewee for Nuclear Hot Seat. Ramana has a ton of credentials. Among them, he is Professor and Simmons Chair of Disarmament, Global, and Human Security at the University of British Columbia, a member of the International Panel on Fissile Materials, the Canadian Pugwash Group, International Nuclear Risk Assessment Group, and he may be familiar to Nuclear Hot Seat listeners as a member of the team that produces the annual World Nuclear Industry Status Report. Note that early in the interview, there are repeated references to the Vogtle nuclear reactors, which are in Georgia, and the never-completed nuclear boondoggle of the VC Summer reactors in South Carolina. I spoke with Ramana on Friday, September 27, 2024. M.V. Ramana, it is so great and such an honor to have you with us this morning on Nuclear Hot Seat.
The honor is mine, Libby. I'm so full of admiration for all the work you've been doing over the many, many years. Thank you so much.
And thank you. I'd like to start out with a quote from the introduction in your book, Nuclear is Not the Solution. This is where you state that your book's, quote, deeper purpose is to demonstrate through the example of nuclear energy why it is important to understand that the climate catastrophe to be as much a crisis of political economy as it is a crisis of ecology resulting from technological choices. There's a lot to unpack in that. Can you give us an overview as to what you mean?
In a way, the book started with my asking what seems like a puzzle to many of us, which is we know that nuclear energy is expensive, it takes a lot of time, it's risky, we don't know how to deal with the radioactive waste it produces, and it's linked with nuclear weapons. We know all of those for decades now. Why is it that governments and corporations are still investing in this technology? Why are they promoting it? That was the fundamental question that I started with. And, as you might see in the book, four of the chapters have to deal with that. The first two chapters are sort of a cataloging of things that at least people who are listening to your program would know only too well. And to me, all of that, whatever I learned in those trying to understand that question, is speaking to the larger society. It's not specific to nuclear energy. It is to how our society is structured in such an unequal fashion with gross inequalities of wealth and power, and how the people who are wealthy use the wealth to get power to get things done the way they want, while at the same time passing on the costs and the risks to the vast majority of the public. And so this is something which we are going to be seeing even if we are thinking about other technologies, be it oil and gas and coal, or even renewables, right? Many of the bad environmental impacts of it and the health impacts of it are outsourced to disempowered communities around the world. Think of where the solar panels might be getting dumped. Think of where the materials for which come from and what are the kind of horrendous conditions under which people mine those things. And they are all indicative of the political economy of our society rather than the technology per se.
Well, that takes care of my first five questions. Okay, let me just edit this down too. One of the quotes you use that struck me is from Noam Chomsky, and he said, "What you have is a system of socialization cost and risk and privatization of profit." How have a handful of large and financially powerful organizations profited from building and operating nuclear power plants at the public's expense?
Let's take the example of the latest power plant that has started operating in the United States, the Vogtle plant. In the book, I document, and I, have to rely completely on activists on the ground in Georgia who are documenting all of this work. And I mention all of them, the groups in the book. They have shown how Georgia Power's profits jumped immediately after the legislative act that allowed Georgia Power to pass on costs to customers. I'll back up and explain a little bit about how the electricity sector in the United States is structured.
Please do.
Historically, the way that the electricity sector has been structured was to allow companies that were supplying electricity to charge customers whatever they are spending, plus a profit margin. So every year, the company would say, here are all our expenses. These are our capital expenses. These are our operating expenses. And we spent, let's say, $100 million. And we want permission to charge the customers X cents per kilowatt hour so that the amount that we are charging is adequate to pay back all of the expenses that we have, plus a profit margin. This has been a well-known problem in the electricity sector in that if a company finds a way to pass on some costs, it's to their benefit, right? They can gold plate their projects and pass on the costs as long as they're allowed to pass on the costs. And the people who allow them to pass on the costs are some regulatory body, sort of a public utilities commission. So the public utilities commission historically have also been compromised in various ways. There is regulatory capture. People who go in and out of these bodies try to then promote the interests of the companies rather than the public, even though they're supposed to be public utilities commission. You know this as, and most of your readers, listeners probably know about this in the case of Georgia, where the utilities commission has been completely taken over. Now, what changed in Georgia and also in South Carolina, where the only other recent project sort of started, was that the companies were allowed by legislation to charge customers even before the nuclear reactor was constructed. So as the construction process started, the bills of these customers went up without any guarantee that they were actually going to get some rewards for that extra cost. And the place where that whole arrangement meant that even though the project was canceled after over $9 billion was spent, customers are still getting charged for it, for electricity they never saw, essentially for a big hole in the ground there. In Georgia, on the other hand, the reactor was completed at an enormous cost increase, and yet the customers were paying not what they originally were told it was going to be costing, but actually for all the extra costs that were spent. But the profits for this went to the owners of the stocks, the financial companies that were owning money or were investing in this project, and to all of the executives in the company. So in South Carolina, again, for the failed project, many of these executives got what were called golden parachutes, where even if the project was to be abandoned, they would get millions of dollars as bonuses. So there are lots of ways in which this arrangement incentivizes companies to A, invest in very expensive projects, in this case, nuclear power plants, and continue with the project, even though it is very apparent that the project was not going to be on time, on budget, or deliver electricity. And this is actually, you can even go further back. The incentive to promote a nuclear project when it was already clear that renewables were much cheaper was also present. It was because of these incentives that utilities were not trying to find out what is the cheapest way to supply electricity, what is the most efficient and the quickest way to supply electricity, and what is the cleanest way. None of that they are interested in, because there's the economic incentives all way in light or in line with them making huge amounts of money if for expensive projects.
You do an extensive and scathing analysis of South Carolina's scandal over the never built or never completed VC Summer nuclear reactors. And as you mentioned earlier, you highlight that the warnings were given against the project by activist groups, environmental groups such as Friends of the Earth, and that all of these warnings were ignored, even though they eventually proved not only accurate, but prescient. They predicted what was going to happen with tremendous accuracy. Could you explain how in the world the voice of reason gets drowned out in these hearings, and the bad path is almost invariably chosen?
There are very powerful interests who benefit from going down this wrong path. I already talked about the case of utility companies. In the case of the legislature and so on, though it's not necessarily clear in South Carolina, in other states, we have seen major corruption scandals. In the case of Ohio, is the most egregious of that, in the case of First Energy. There are interests for legislators also to actually pass on these costs to customers. And the customers and their representatives, the civil society organizations and the environmental organizations, including Friends of the Earth in the case of South Carolina, and activists like Tom Clements, have very little capacity to influence these people in comparison with all of these very moneyed interests. They don't have the lobbying capacity. They don't have the capacity to go and wine and dine all these people, right? All you can do is to show up at hearings and try to put in your testimony, go have demonstrations, write letters, write op-eds, but they can all be ignored by legislators because they are not fundamentally accountable. And this is, I think, again, one of those questions about larger political economy, larger society.
One of the things that I have found most frustrating, and it happens across the board, is that the media lead with the nuclear industry's perspective and talking points. And of course, that's reinforced by World Nuclear News from the World Nuclear Association. And it's like accepted truth is not true when it comes to the media's reporting. Do you have any insights on how those of us who oppose nuclear and have the truth, such as when Friends of the Earth were speaking, or any of the activist groups speaking to public utilities commissions, or here in California, the Coastal Commission, or the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, do you have any insights on how we might be better and more powerful in putting our points across?
Yeah, maybe this question needs to be rephrased because I don't have an answer for that, right? I mean, we are all struggling with it and we are getting our asses kicked on so many different fronts. So yes, we need to do something different. I don't think I know really the answer. Set of things that I do, you know, I write op-eds, I write books, I go and talk to people, to, you know, groups, to civil society organizations, things of that sort. But in the larger scheme of things, we are not able to shift the needle. The forces that are against us are so powerful. The only thing we have on our side are facts and a lot of committed people who seem to be very sincere in their work and who are willing to do this tirelessly and without reward. That's what we have on our side. But in terms of trying to match up with the money and the political power of the nuclear industry, it's a very difficult thing.
I'm certainly working on some media angles, especially for next year, 2025, which is the 80th anniversary of the start of all this nuclear mess.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we're up against is that the media always leads in nuclear stories with the nuclear industry talking points. And maybe down at the bottom, if it's print, there's a paragraph that quotes somebody who's an activist saying, no, this really isn't a good idea. But we don't get that primacy in the articles. Why do you see it that the media is doing this?
I think there are two angles. The first is most journalists are working on extremely tight timelines. The media industry has been shrinking. There's very little money out there. And so these people have to file stories enormously fast. And they really, what they do is cutting and pasting from various press releases, you know, a quote here, a quote there. And then, of course, they get a token quote from somebody who will be described as an anti-nuclear activist, right, or something of that sort. And when you are described that way, you're already being discounted by the reader. So it's heavily tailored against us. But I think there's also, interestingly, if you were to ask people in the nuclear industry, they will probably say that the media is biased against them. And they would probably say, oh, you know, the media always talks about Chernobyl or Fukushima or all of these negative stories. They don't tell the great attributes of nuclear. And this is something which we have seen in the nuclear industry for many years now. They are complaining always that their great attributes are not recognized. They would love to say how they are a clean source of power, all within quotes, of course, how they are a reliable source of power, and the media doesn't highlight all of that. I think one reason why we both sides see the media in different ways as being against their interests is that the media, I think, tries to operate within a narrow space to deal with the climate crisis, for example. They want to say that we can solve the climate problem just using some technologies here, rather than asking any larger questions about our society, about how it needs to change, about our politics, and so on and so forth. They don't want to ask any of these larger questions. So they like stories that make you feel good, that we can solve the problem without doing anything major. Change a few bulbs here, put on a solar panel on your roof, and build a few nuclear plants. And they see all of them in the same way. That, I think, is a fundamental challenge. And this has to do with also who controls the media. The media is controlled by very rich people who benefit from the current social setup. They don't want anything to be messed up here. You know, in my book, I also point out that this is part of the reason why we see billionaires like Bill Gates and Sam Altman and so on also promoting nuclear energy. They don't necessarily gain a lot of personal wealth from it, but they are really invested in making sure that nobody asks fundamental questions. So when there is, you know, Greta Thunberg or somebody like that who is asking deep changes in our society, they really do not like that. And I think the media also shares the same set of assumptions.
There's so much in your book to go over because you provide the basics and then you build upon them. One of the points you make early on is that the consequences of nuclear expansion will fall primarily on poor, marginalized, often indigenous communities. How intentional is that by the industry?
Intention is not something we can really know because we can't go inside their heads or we don't go inside their boardrooms to ask for us to hear them say that. But given that there is so much documentation about how bad uranium mining has been to indigenous communities, all of the other risks associated with this, there is no doubt that they ought to know about it. And if they are going ahead and planning their projects, you can either attribute intentionality or deliberately avoiding thinking about it and talking about it. And this again is typical, I think, of a lot of how we carry on activities in our society, which is try and outsource the harmful consequences onto some other population that is not going to be so powerful. Again, this is true for many other industries, like, plastics, for example, or all kinds of other materials that we use. But in the case of the nuclear industry, I think they are trying to pretend to be clean. And therefore, having all of these environmental and health impacts not be seen by majority communities and, being visited only on small, disempowered communities, which are typically geographically far away, helps them maintain that image more easily than if it had been, for example, if we have to construct the Yucca Mountain repository, not in Yucca Mountain, but in, let's say, in the Bay Area in California. Things would be very different because the people there would be like, okay, what's happening here? What's subjecting myself and my descendants to? But when it's in Yucca Mountain, it's far away. The nuclear industry typically talks about it being a isolated or abandoned or unoccupied area that it becomes very easy for them to minimize or to hide the impacts.
Another part of hiding the impact, which you address in the book, is the fact that people don't understand about radiation and that the nuclear industry, using the word you use, pretends that radiation is not linked to any kind of health prospect, or they diminish any concern about radiation. What do you say to that?
That is a very central element in much of the nuclear propaganda we see. The idea that low levels of radiation are not harmful, that there's a threshold below which either there is no health impact, or in the eyes of some really crazy people, that the health impact is actually beneficial. This is the hormesis, folks. It's a very central element, not just in the propaganda of the nuclear industry and its supporters, but even in the way that most regulation is done. So, if you think about how a nuclear power plant is licensed for construction by, let's say, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission or the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, they have a set of standards. And in principle, what they are trying to show is that the radiation exposure of members of the public will be lower than a certain level. And why is that important? Because of the kind of pretense that at very low levels, the impact can be forgotten about. Of course, they would come back and say, well, everything we do has impacts and so on and so forth. But in the case of radiation, we know it is very special in that the impact continues in what scientists call a linear fashion, meaning that the effect is proportional to the dose, to the lowest possible levels that we know of. That seems to be the most cautious way to approach the uncertainties that are associated with the low levels of radiation. And I'll also add that the nuclear industry has adopted the same kind of techniques as the tobacco industry used to use when they were trying to diminish the health impacts of smoking. And as one slogan said, doubt is our product. And the idea is to create the idea of uncertainty in people's minds. That radiation, maybe it's helpful, maybe it's not so bad. That's exactly what they want you to think about and hopefully forget about it. This is, I think, one of those cases again where the facts are on our side. There's scientific consensus among a lot of very established organizations, including the National Academy of Sciences, Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation Committees, and various groups of scientists. They have all put out reports and academic papers pointing out that the evidence suggests that the radiation risk never goes to zero until you get to a zero level of radiation. And the last thing I want to say is one of the other arguments that the nuclear industry often talks about is, oh, this is going to be small compared to all of the other radiation you're exposed to. This is why they like to use comparisons with X-rays or dental X-rays, or more absurdly, the idea that when you eat bananas, you get a certain radiation dose. Or sometimes they also talk about how if you're sleeping with a partner, you get a certain radiation dose because all our bodies have a certain amount of potassium 40 and all these kinds of absurd ideas. Now, we can try and debate all of those things, and people have done that. But the thing to remember is that what is happening from natural sources is something we cannot avoid. We don't want to avoid sleeping with your partner if you have one, just because you're going to get a radiation dose. But the nuclear industry's dose, the radiation dose that you get from the nuclear industry, is totally egregious in the sense that we don't really find the electricity that it provides of great value. It's expensive. If it's a product that we really, really want, then we might argue that some amount of risk is something we should all undertake to be exposed to. But given that nuclear power is such a poor way of generating electricity, this whole thing is quite absurd, just in my opinion.
We'll continue with this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, I know you care about getting honest nuclear news. And that's what we set out to provide here at Nuclear Hot Seat every week. Verifiable nuclear information that's been sourced, checked, and footnoted, plus interviews with people who are genuine experts on various aspects of the nuclear industry and its impact on life, health, and our shared genetic future. We also tell you about people on the front lines of activism around the world, their triumphs, challenges, and how you can help them. We get underneath the manicured exterior of mainstream media's nuclear stories to provide context and continuity, because we want you to understand what the issues are, what we are up against, and what any of us can do about it. But this show cannot survive without your support. So if you're grateful for the information you get from Nuclear Hot Seat, now is the time to help us out. We run on donations, and right now, quite frankly, our expenses are far outstripping what we've been sent. So if you've ever thought of donating to Nuclear Hot Seat as a good idea, but you haven't done so yet, now is the exact right time to get it going. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that anything you donate is tax deductible. And we make it easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Any amount is welcomed. You can make this a one-time donation or an ongoing recurring one, be it $5, $500, $5,000. All amounts are welcome. So don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate right now. And know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care.
Here is the conclusion of our interview with M.V. Ramana on his new book, Nuclear is Not the Solution.
There's been a growing push for what the industry refers to as SMRs, small modular reactors, which very neatly takes out the word nuclear. So I refer to them as SMNRs, or small modular nuclear reactors. And governments around the world are jumping on that bandwagon, throwing ever greater amounts of money at companies that claim to be able to make these modular, cute, I call them like Legos, that get stuck together nuclear reactors. And there's a lot that's wrong with them. First, what is the difference between the older generation of nuclear reactors, the large ones that we have that are in operation, and these proposed new ones?
The term small modular reactors, it is meant to also evoke the idea of it being physically small, cute things that you can put in your neighborhood. But in reality, a small reactor, the small part of that only refers to the power output. A small modular nuclear reactor is defined as one whose power output is less than 300 megawatts. That's the International Atomic Energy Agency's definition. So the 300 megawatts is roughly about a third of the size of the typical reactor we construct today. We usually say it's about 1,000 megawatts. The reactors that were built in Vogel are designed to generate 1,100 megawatts each. So that gives you a sense of scale. But the physical size of the reactor depends sensitively on what kind of nuclear reactor it is. Different designs, some designs can be smaller and some could be larger, and there's no connection between that. The other term, modular, is supposed to evoke exactly the point that exactly the way you put it, as Lego blocks that come together. In this case, what they say is these are factory-built objects. So let me start with that. So modular construction is something we do all the time, right? If you think about a neighboring apartment complex that is being built or an office building that's built, nobody brings bricks and wood and carpenters to the site to actually brick and make all the windows and the doors there. Everything is shipped to the place from factories, and all that is being done there is mostly assembly of these different components. It's exactly that process that is sought to be used in making small modular reactors. But that process was also used to make the AP1000 reactors that were constructed in Georgia. Westinghouse, at the turn of the century, when they were promoting not just the AP1000, but even the precursor to that, the AP600 design, which was in the 1990s, Westinghouse's attempt to come up with a new reactor design. They would say, because of this modular construction process that we have, and the design is modularly, is meant to be constructed in a modular fashion, we will be able to cut the time of construction. And it's going to be really fast. And for a long time now, it's no longer there on their website, but they used to have a little animated video which would show different parts of the reactor coming together. So it'll be month one, month two, month three, and it'll go on till 36 months. That used to be their time they would promise, and the thing would come together. On screen, it looks absolutely great. But unfortunately, what works on the screen doesn't work in the real world. So that's the modular. We have no reason to think that small modular reactors are going to be any different. They are also going to be delayed. They are also going to have problems that, if not happening in the site of construction, will happen in the factory, as happened in the case of AP1000s. But I want to come back to the small part, which I think is even more interesting. Around the world, countries that started to build nuclear power plants in the 1950s and 60s and so on, started by building small reactors. The first reactors that were built in the United States and Canada and India, all of them would fit the definition of small. They are all low-powered reactors. And then over a period of time, the nuclear industry started increasing the power levels. Why did they do that? Because they were trying to take advantage of what are called economies of scale. When you build a reactor that generates five times as much electricity, the company that owns it will sell five times as much electricity, will get five times as much revenue for it. But they don't have to spend five times as much money to build a reactor because, let's say, a 1,500 megawatt reactor does not need five times as much concrete as a 300 megawatt reactor. It doesn't need five times as many workers as a 300 megawatt reactor. So you save on costs when you go to larger sizes. And that's exactly why the nuclear industry started building bigger and bigger reactors. Despite all those economies of scale, nuclear power is the most expensive way to generate electricity today. And so this is the real conundrum that nobody wants to order nuclear plants because they are so expensive and you have to do all this political machination before you can get an order for a nuclear plant. So they come up with this new story saying, oh, we have these new designs, the so-called small modular reactors. Those are going to be somehow much faster, much cheaper, and so on and so forth. But if you look under the bonnet, as it were, there is no reason to expect that small modular reactors will solve any of the problems. There are, broadly speaking, four kinds of problems the nuclear industry itself sees for itself. In 2003, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology put out a report called The Future of Nuclear Power. This was kind of the height of the early stages of what is called the nuclear renaissance at that point. And they mentioned that there were four problems we have. The cost problem, the fact that there's a risk of accidents, that it produces nuclear waste, radioactive waste that we don't know how to deal with, and that there's a linkage with nuclear weapons proliferation. Now, of these four problems, three of the problems, the waste, the risk of accidents, and the linkage with nuclear weapons, are inherent to all nuclear reactors, whether they are small or large. Even a small modular reactor will produce enough plutonium to, let's say, make about 10 bombs every year. A small reactor, which is only generating, let's say, 200 megawatts. So that's really small in terms of how much electricity it supplies to a country, but it is quite a large amount of plutonium for use in nuclear weapons. So that's one of the challenges with this. And of course, all nuclear reactors have to produce radioactive waste because that's an inherent part of the nuclear fission process, right, which is how you produce the heat. And I want to remind the listeners that a nuclear reactor ultimately is just a very complicated way to boil water using a hazardous process of nuclear fission. And so all of these attributes are related to that. And the reason why nuclear power plants are so expensive is because you're trying very hard to make sure that this radioactive material never exits into the biosphere, that there's no accident that allows this material to come out of the reactor and be spread out. But nevertheless, it's impossible to design a nuclear reactor with no possibility of an accident. The probability of an accident will always be greater than zero. And despite what the nuclear industry says, and I've sort of explained this more in my book, there is no way to reliably calculate what the risk of an accident is, what the probability of an accident is. And all of these methods that they use have uncertainties. I've said a lot of things, but I just want to recap what I'm saying. All nuclear power plants have these three fundamental problems having to do with the physics of the reactor, the risk of accidents, the production of radioactive waste, and the linkage with nuclear weapons. And because of these things, the fourth problem that they face, the high cost of construction, is a result of all of these problems. Now, when you go to small reactors, how does the picture change? The most important element, I think, is thinking about the cost of it. Because of what I mentioned earlier about economies of scale, a small nuclear reactor will always be more expensive than a large nuclear reactor per unit of capacity, either power capacity or energy production. That's ultimately the most important metric. It's not the total cost. For the industry, it may be the total cost, because one of the lessons they learned from all of the rounds of nuclear reactors that were constructed in the post-nuclear renaissance era, whether it's Vogel or whether it's Flamanville in France or Olkiluoto in Finland or the ongoing Hinkley Point project in the UK, is that the total absolute cost of these reactor projects is enormous. $35 billion, $40 billion. These are not amounts that most utilities actually have access to. So this is where the nuclear industry is coming in and saying, oh, you can build a small modular reactor because that will only cost you $3 billion or $5 billion. And that money you can probably find somewhere or the other. But the problem is that the $3 billion will fetch you far less electricity than the larger reactor project, right? So on a per unit basis, it's actually going to be more expensive.
That's a really thorough explanation of the economics behind. So let's get to the physical reality or lack thereof of these so-called small modular nuclear reactors. And that is, do any currently exist? Are any in operation? Are there prototypes? And are there any approved designs for building them?
Yes and no. There are two small modular reactor projects operating in Russia and in China. There are two floating power plants that Russia has operated since 2020, I think, for the last few years. Then there are two reactors, high-temperature gas-cooled reactors, that China bought online a couple of years ago. What we can say about both of those projects is, one, they also demonstrated all of the problems we've seen with nuclear projects. They were delayed. They were more expensive than they were initially costed at. And the second thing we have learned from them is that they are not operating very well. the Russian reactors, what we call the capacity factor, the efficiency with which the reactor is producing electricity, is around 30% in every year. Whereas the US nuclear reactors, when they are operating, for example, will operate around 90% capacity factor. So small modular reactors that are operating don't seem to be operating very well. The Chinese case is even more interesting in that within a year of the reactor being brought into commercial operation, the power output had to be reduced by 25%. It came down from 200 megawatt to 150 megawatt. We have no idea why, because China is not very transparent with all of its data. And secondly, that reactor, even at the lower power level in 2023, produced only enough power that it could have produced in 1 month of operation during the year. So it's almost as though for 11 months of the year, it was not operating. And then in the 12th month, suddenly it produced a certain amount of power. But of course, in reality, that's not how it would have probably operated. It was probably operating at a lower power level and going, you know, working and not working. And the integrated total amounts to 1 month of power output.
Other than China and Russia, speaking of the Western world, there's this big push by the US, by the UK, throughout the world to install small modular nuclear reactors. And I think that's what I'm looking for. Is there a standard design? Are there any prototypes? Do we know the technology will work? Does the technology exist anywhere except on some elaborate PowerPoints?
That's a great question. At one level, we can expect the technology to work in the sense that it's probably possible to build one of these nuclear reactors and have it produce electricity. But the question we should be asking is, will it be built on time? Will it be built on budget? Will it have a risk of accident? What are the risks of accidents associated? Those are the questions we should be asking. As I mentioned earlier, I think the examples of Russia and China are instructive in that they have tried to build these projects, and they demonstrate all of the problems we have seen with nuclear power plants, right? And so there's no reason to expect the United States power plants, SMRs, will be any different. And I'll also mention one other project, which is in the West, but not in the North. It's in Argentina. Argentina has been building a small modular reactor called CHARM since 2014. And at that time, they were predicting, when the construction started, that the reactor will be operating by late 2017 or early 2018.
Right? the clocks run differently in the nuke world.
Exactly, right? So it's now 2024. Now they say 2028, but nobody really believes that's going to happen there. Coming to the United States, the only design that has been licensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is NuScale's 50 megawatt design. NuScale submitted that design. It was approved with some very important caveats. There were issues that had to be addressed, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, in my opinion, should not have given them the approval without ensuring that the issues they identified had been resolved by NuScale. But I think they were under political pressure to show that they can operate fast, and so they gave the approval. What is interesting is that between the time NuScale submitted that design for approval and the approval came, NuScale had changed its mind. It had increased the size of the output of the reactor from 50 megawatts to 60 megawatts and then to 77 megawatts. If you go to the NuScale website, you won't even see the 50 megawatt design advertised there anymore. Now, NuScale has gone back to NRC and said, okay, now we have a 7 megawatt design. Now, you already approved our 50 megawatt design. Why don't you approve this one as well? And again, NRC has asked them a bunch of questions. In the meanwhile, NuScale's first sort of flagship project, the one that was proposed for UAMS, that project was canceled last November because the cost estimate had gone up to $9.3 billion. And that, I think, is very important because it's not just the fact that the cost was $9.3 billion, much higher than the $3, $4 billion they were initially talking about. But also, if you think about how much power you would have got for that $9.3 billion, it perfectly illustrates the lack of economies of scale that I mentioned earlier. So for $9.3 billion, this is the cost before the construction started, before any of the usual type of cost overruns happened, right? This is the cost estimate. $9.3 billion 460 megawatts means that the per megawatt or per kilowatt cost is more than the cost of Vogel. And this is all before all of the cost overruns. So actually the thing to compare with is actually the cost of Vogel when construction started. At that time, it was supposed to be $14 billion for around 2,200 megawatts. And if you do math, you will find that this is about 250% of that cost estimate. So NuScale is already uneconomical without even the construction starting, right? So I don't think we really need many, many more experiments of this sort. But of course, you know, all of these countries, all of these very powerful institutions, including the Department of Energy in the US, and in Canada, we have our share of these nuclear promoters, are sending money to these people. In the US, it's in the hundreds of millions of dollars. In Canada, it's in the tens of millions of dollars, hoping to be able to get one of these projects going. And so every now and then you see, you know, $100 million here, you know, $200 million there. And the latest, I think, is DOE wants to give $800 million, if I remember right, for, they don't say NuScale, but everything, you know, about the description suggests that it is going to be NuScale. And this is on top of something like $560 million they have already funded NuScale. So they're sort of in this position of having spent some money and they want to throw more good money after bad. And that's exactly, I think, that's the unfortunate situation we are in. I'd also say one last thing about SMRs. The government investments in these small modular reactors projects seem to be very large amounts. But on the scale of what is required to actually move one of these reactor designs from conception to the point where it is being licensed by NRC and ready for construction is of the order of $2 billion. NuScale has said it has spent already $1.8 billion and it is not yet ready for construction. So that, I think, is something to remember. So, you know, when X Energy or any of these other companies say they have got $35 million or $75 million from DOE, that's really a drop in the bucket.
It sounds like small modular nuclear reactors are really the equivalent of a naked emperor, that there's something there and people are just refusing to see how bad they are. Be it a small reactor or a large one, given that once a nuclear reactor starts up and begins producing radioactive waste, highly radioactive waste, we are stuck with supporting the nuclear industry forever. They propose a technology that creates the problem, they maintain the problem, and then even after the reactors stop operating, we're stuck with the problem that goes into infinity because the stuff is radioactive for a minimum of a quarter of a million years. In your opinion and in your understanding of the science, is there a way out of this?
There's no good way out. We are now fated to deal with all of this radioactive waste all over the world in many, many different countries. And there is no good way of dealing with it. The only answer the nuclear industry has come up with is to bury it in a deep hole somewhere, right? Dig a deep hole, bury it, and leave it there, right? They don't, of course, call it a deep hole. They would call it a deep geological repository, but that's just a fancy term for a hole there. There is no guarantee that this material will not get out of there. It is not possible for them to give us a guarantee. They can do all these elaborate calculations to show that the probability is low and the radiation dose is going to be only so small and so on and so forth. But there are lots of assumptions involved in those calculations, including, for example, we have no idea how people in, let's say, the 31st century are going to be behaving. What are they going to be mining for? How are they going to be conducting their business, et cetera, et cetera. We don't really know any of these things. You can make some assumptions, but not. You know, the other strange thing, of course, with these repositories is that we have no way of even communicating to those people that there is something bad buried here. Given all of these problems, I don't think we actually have any satisfactory solution. We can choose between a bunch of bad solutions, but I think all of that, for at least on the side of us who are protesting or who are critical of the nuclear industry, I think that's secondary to actually the more important point, which is before we come to a solution, before we can agree on a solution, we have to agree to stop producing this material. That is very clear. I think it was Will Rogers who was supposed to have said, when you find yourself in a hole, the first thing you have to do is to stop digging. That's the most important thing. Unfortunately for us, the nuclear industry sees nuclear waste as a public relations problem. And so they really would like to set up a repository, and they kind of appeal to all of our better senses. They will say, oh, you know, it's our responsibility to deal with this safely. We don't want to pass on this burden to our children and grandchildren. So won't you agree to do a repository? And of course, they will go to one of these disempowered poor communities that I mentioned and say, hey, you know, how would you like a $1 billion project in your neighborhood? You know, think of all the jobs it's going to create. It's a high-tech opportunity. You're going to make history by being the first place in this country to be able to deal with this. How about it? It's all a public relations game, essentially. But the moment one of these things get sanctioned and things start buried underground, they will turn around and say, we have solved the problem. Let's get on with the business of building more nuclear reactors. And I think that that dynamic means that we are not going to be the ones who should be telling them, here's what you should be doing with the solution, in my opinion. I think what we should be doing is to say, let's first talk about production before we talk about how you're going to dispose it.
One point we haven't yet talked about is the connection between nuclear power and nuclear weapons. Most people are unaware that nuclear weapons and nuclear reactors are connected with the other. They're intrinsically joined at the hip with each other. What is that about, and how would you explain that to people so they can understand and get that they're not two separate stories and two separate issues? They're the same thing.
Yeah, the relationship between nuclear weapons and nuclear energy, the technologies to generate nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, and the technology to make nuclear weapons material are inextricably linked. Five types of linkages that I talk about in the book. The first is history. We know that the first nuclear reactors were constructed to make plutonium to make nuclear weapons that were dropped on Hiroshima, on Nagasaki, and also the one that was tested even before that in New Mexico on July 16, 1945. So the first nuclear reactors were made for that. In many countries, this was the case. The first nuclear reactors in many of the countries that have nuclear weapons were built for making material for nuclear weapons. Historically, that's how the technology even spread to many, many of these countries, because they tried to get the technology to make nuclear weapons, and then they kind of spun off a nuclear energy industry from that technology. The second linkage, which I think is also apparent, is the geographical overlap. So there are roughly around 30-odd countries around the world that have nuclear power plants. The vast majority of these nuclear power plants are in countries that have nuclear weapons. The United States, China, France, the UK, Russia, India, Pakistan, all of these have nuclear weapons and nuclear power plants. And if you include countries like Canada, where I live, and you know many of the Western European countries, which are linked to nuclear weapon states like the United States, to military alliances, then the overlap is even more overwhelming. That's, I think, a second kind of overlap. Then there's the technology that I kind of mentioned, which is that the two fundamental ways in which you can make nuclear weapons, materials for nuclear weapons, is to enrich uranium into what's called highly enriched uranium, or actually weapons-grade uranium, and plutonium. The bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima was based on weapons-grade uranium. What was dropped on Nagasaki was based on plutonium. Now, all nuclear power plants operating in the United States use low-enriched uranium, that is uranium in which the uranium-235 component has been increased from what is found in nature, which is about 0.7%, to something like 3 to 5%. The process by which you produce that low-enriched uranium, you can use exactly the same process to keep concentrating the uranium-235 to make it weapons-grade uranium. And this is actually the source of the concern about Iran. Iran claims that it has a peaceful nuclear program, and it is trying to enrich uranium because it wants to build nuclear reactors for power and for research. But everybody else says, well, you know, that is also going to allow you to make material for weapons, and we don't trust you to not do that. So this is an inherent challenge. And Iran, because of the relations with the United States, is seen as suspect. But if it's a country that is friendly with the United States will say, oh, that's okay, they're not going to do this. So it becomes a matter of trust. But the other material, plutonium, is something just produced in all nuclear reactors. As long as they are fueled by uranium, there will be plutonium in the cores of these reactors, and they can be extracted through the chemical process called reprocessing. In both cases, whether it's uranium enrichment or reprocessing and plutonium, ultimately it becomes a matter of intent of these countries rather than capacity. Once a country has these nuclear program, they will have some of the materials that they are, is required to make nuclear weapons. There are two other connections I want to mention, which is the connection between personnel. The people who are trained to build and operate nuclear power plants also inadvertently receive training that can be used to make materials for nuclear weapons. The perfect illustration of this was the country of Pakistan. When Pakistan first embarked on the idea that it wanted to have a nuclear program, people looked at what was the state of educational resources in Pakistan, and they concluded that Pakistan just didn't have the necessary trained people. What allowed Pakistan to eventually set up a nuclear program, which then developed nuclear weapons, was the Atoms for Peace program that was started by President Eisenhower in 1953. And Pakistani scientists and engineers came over to the United States, got trained, went back, and they set up the program. The same thing happened in the case of Iran. In the 1970s, the Shah of Iran decided he was going to build nuclear power plants. He sent a bunch of people, including to MIT. And in fact, MIT got a whole bunch of money to train these people specially. And some of them are the ones who are heading the Iranian nuclear program today. So that's the fourth thing. The fifth is institutional. In many countries, it's the same institution that oversees nuclear weapons and promotes nuclear energy. In the United States, that's the Department of Energy. In India, it is the Department of Atomic Energy. So there's an institutional interest. And Indian case, I think, is particularly interesting because the Department of Atomic Energy was initially set up only to do atomic energy for peaceful purposes. Eventually, they branched off into making nuclear weapons, and they realized there was a lot of political power to be obtained by doing that. And so they have no interest in giving up their nuclear weapons pursuits because it is providing them with huge budgets and political clout. So there are all these connections. I think there are two other things I do want to mention here, because this is all sort of evident to people who go and study this business. The reason why many people don't see the connection is because the nuclear industry actively promotes the idea that there is a difference between nuclear power plants and nuclear weapons. They will always tell you, oh, a nuclear power plant is not going to explode like a nuclear bomb. You're just completely misinformed. Of course, nobody is saying that a nuclear reactor is what is going to explode, though it can happen. That's a separate point. But what we are saying is there are strong connections, and they want to deny that, except when they are in financial trouble. When they are in financial trouble, they turn around and they say, look, our nuclear power industry is suffering, is having financial troubles, and you, the government, ought to come and subsidize us. Why? Because we are actually helping you with all of your defense programs. So this is what happened in, let's say, 2017. When the Trump administration came to power, the nuclear industry knew that the climate change argument was not going to work. So they immediately turned and they said, we are going to campaign on basically two points. One is the linkage with the weapons industry, with the Defense Department, especially because a lot of people who work in nuclear power plants are people who have been trained in the nuclear Navy to operate nuclear submarines. And then once they retire from the Navy, they go on to working in nuclear power plants. So this is a kind of a two-way door, as it were. And then the other argument, of course, they used to make was, we are going to create jobs, which is another absurd argument. We don't want to talk about it. But in the Trump administration, of course, that can sell because Trump was selling the idea of jobs everywhere. This is actually part of a trend in the UK, too. When the nuclear industry was in trouble, the nuclear energy industry, they appealed to the government to bail them out, to support them in various ways, because they would contribute to the Trident nuclear submarine in the UK. So this is a pattern where they can use this connection when they want it, and they want to hide the connection when they don't want it.
Ramana, it's good to know that some people have their eye on the ball and are able to translate it in such a way that we can understand it. So for your expertise, for your amazingly wonderful book, Nuclear is Not the Solution, The Folly of Atomic Power in the Age of Climate Change. That's the subtitle. I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Libby, thank you so much for inviting me, for talking to me. And I deeply, deeply admire all of the work you've been doing ever since Fukushima. I've been listening to your show regularly, and I've learned a ton from that.
Physicist and author M. V. Ramana. We'll have a link up on our website to his book, Nuclear is Not the Solution, The Folly of Atomic Power in the Age of Climate Change. That will be under Nuclear Hot Seat episode
number 742.
Meanwhile, to help you see the kind of lies the nuclear industry promotes about the building of new nuclear reactors, we have a link to the now deleted but fortunately saved by Ramana 2014 Westinghouse animation, which showcases a new build of an AP1000 nuclear reactor in just 116 weeks. Note that the ability to achieve this is a total fiction. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat
for Tuesday, September 16, 2025.
If you want to make certain you never miss another episode of Nuclear Hot Seat, we make it easy because you can get it delivered via email every week. Sign up for it at nuclearhotseat.com by filling out the yellow box. First name, email address. We don't bug you. We just send you one email a week, which contains a link to that week's show and a brief rundown of some of the material that's in it. You also have the option of going to your favorite podcast service and signing up for Nuclear Hot Seat there, because we are everywhere. And we don't want you to miss any episodes, because this story just keeps moving. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, really important, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Nothing is too small. Nothing is too big. It all helps, and we really appreciate and need your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that as Tomoyuki Mimaki, the 82-year-old co-chair of the Nobel Peace Prize-winning Nihon Hideyanko, said, please abolish nuclear weapons while we are still alive. There you have it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the Nuclear Hot Seat.
Nuclear Hot Seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear Hot Seat. It's da bomb.